but to welcome Roy Hattersley, who will be introduced by Ian Smith from the History Department.
Well, good evening, and to another session of Writers at Warwick. I think it's entirely in character that our speaker tonight, Roy Hattersley, when he was awarded a peerage in 1997, only uses the title for purposes to do with the House of Lords. He was born and grew up in Sheffield, and he's written about his Yorkshire childhood with amazing clarity and recall. If you want to know what it was like growing up in a context of old labour in the 1940s and 50s, I don't think you can do better than read his Yorkshire boyhood. He was elected to Parliament in 1964, and he served in all the cabinets of Harold Wilson and also that of Jim Callaghan. And he was leader of the Labour Party from 1983 to 1992. Now, alongside a career of over 30 years in politics, he's also had a career as a prolific writer of books, some 14 to my count, and the pace seems to be accelerating during the past decade. And they're all in a great variety of genres. He has written biographies, autobiography, political essays and polemics, what he calls a prejudiced history of Britain since the war, called 50 Years On, which gives a very lively and self-effacing account of the events and developments in this country during his own lifetime. But the book that sold more copies than any of the others is Buster's Diaries. The allegedly told memoirs, reflections of his dog. It's been a bestseller. During the past decade, he's written three novels and a remarkably funny, self-deprecating autobiography. In addition to books, he's done much regular work for radio and television and has had a long career in journalism. His weekly end piece in The Guardian ran for something like 14 years, I think. His career as a writer has accelerated during the past decade, and his most recent book has been a remarkable dual biography of William and Catherine Booth and the Salvation Army, entitled Blood and Iron. Copies of this and many of his other books can be bought, as you know, in the bookshop after the question session that follows his talk, and if you take your ticket, you get a 20% discount. And Roy Hattersley has agreed to sign copies of any of those of you who would like to have copies brought here to be signed. So, Roy Hattersley, I leave it now for you to address us.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, because of my misspent youth. Thank you very much. Because of my misspent youth, I can only speak standing up. So I fear I must address you from behind this contraption. And I fear I must begin by explaining or justifying my presence here. If any of you had ever heard of me before the notices went up, I'm sure you thought of me as a politician. And indeed, I was a politician for very many years, elected to a council when I was 21, in the House of Commons for 33 years, and a very happy politician for all that time. But I'm a politician no longer. I'll tell you why towards the end of my 40 minutes. And I think of myself now as entirely as a writer. And whilst I certainly want to talk about the last two books, the books that came out last year and the year before, I think perhaps I ought to explain, I owe you an explanation of the strange transition from a political enthusiast, a political fanatic in some ways, in the sense that politics seemed to me then, and in a sense seemed to be now, the most important activity that can take place in the civilized community, how I moved from that view of life to wanting to do nothing except write, which is all I do. I walk the dog, I write, I go to see Sheffield Wednesday play most Saturday afternoons, but that is my existence. Now, I can actually pinpoint the time when it began, which is 1945, which in one book, I think, Who Goes Home, I call the Year of Victories. The Allies won the war, the Labour Party won the general election, and I won a scholarship to the Sheffield Grammar School, and went off like other boys and girls of 11, and were taken into the stock room behind my Form 1 classroom, and given a bundle of second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand books tied together with string. Last year's first form had left them. All the books, some of you can remember. North and Hilliard, Latin Primer, is one that comes immediately to mind. But amongst them was a collection called More Essays by Modern Masters. Just to prove how stupid I am innately, it was in my 30s that I realised that if there was a book called More Essays by Modern Masters, there must be a book called Essays by Modern Masters. But it was More Essays by Modern Masters, which I took home, started to read, and it was in fact pieces of journalism. I didn't realise it at the time, but it was the English light essay, as popularised from late Victorian England till the beginning of the Second World War, as written by Belloc, Lucas, Chesterton, Priestley and Lind. It was the light essay, ideally 1,500 words, which is carried along by the quality of the writing, not by the information that it contains. It doesn't tell you of something sensational that you need to read from the front page of the paper. It tells you of something which is perhaps whimsical, perhaps slightly sentimental, but the carried along by its writing. And I knew at the age of 11 that's what I wanted to write. These were inconsequential by nature. When Chesterton put all his essays together, he called the volume Tremendous Trifles. That is the nature of the operation. And I remember when I got into the sixth form of the Sheffield Grammar School, going off on a geography expedition to Ingleton, to the three Yorkshire peaks, Ingleborough, Wernside and Penigent. You see, I'm now so self-confident that I admit to studying geography in the sixth form, an admission that I wouldn't have made in less secure days. But I went off to the expedition and had to write an account of it for the school magazine. And one of our number, I remember, had a minor stomach upset on day three. And I wrote that despite one of our colleagues being struck down, we decided to press on. And Mr. Etchells, in charge of the magazine, said, "You can't write in this style. This sounds like Scott's last expedition to the pole." And I said, "It's irony, Mr. Etchells, it's irony." And he said, "I don't care what it's called, it's not going in the school magazine." And I've been having that sort of argument with editors of one sort or another ever since. But whilst I knew I wanted to write this sort of essay, I was in a sense overtaken by my great political enthusiasm. That same year, 1945, when I was 11, I delivered leaflets in the general election, and I was carried along by the romance of politics. When I was an undergraduate, I began to realise why I was in this tribal institute and called the Labour Party, my great belief, abiding belief in equality. But as a student and shortly afterwards, writing became a peripheral occupation, which didn't come back to me until, well, I was in the cabinet in the late 70s when I started doing odd bits for the New Statesman and for the Listener. Always in the cabinet with the explicit approval of the Prime Minister. Probably no cabinet ministers can only write matters of artistic or literary merit is the instruction. Even then you have to show it to the Prime Minister for his approval. The famous example of this is Strachey, War Minister in 1947, coming back from setting up of the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization and writing a poem about it, which he submitted to Downing Street and clamatly refused to allow it to be published. And Strachey, with the confidence of an old Etonian, saw the Prime Minister and said, "There's nothing to do with security in the poem. There's nothing that's embarrassment to the party. Why won't you let me publish it?" Which Attlee said, "Doesn't rhyme, doesn't scan, can't be published." Well, Jim Callaghan was never quite like that. But I persuaded him to let me do a few things, which I thought were light essays. And then we lost the general election. And general election of 79. And my old friend, Tony Howard, recently retired as deputy editor of the Times, suggested I wrote a political column for the listener. And I said, I don't want to write a political column. I want to write a light essay at the back. Something I had, in fact, done once or twice for The Spectator during the 2 years that I was first in the House and I wasn't in the government. But let me tell you about my Spectator inauguration, because it's the sort of coincidence that changes people's lives. I was a great admirer of Hugh Gaitskell. Indeed, my political life has been delineated, happy though I've been, by three deaths. Hugh Gaitskell in 62, Tony Crosson 23 years ago, and John Smith shortly after the general election of 1992. And I believed in 64 that although Harold Wilson was the toast of the newspapers, the Gannex raincoat, the white heat of technological revolution, the real victory had been secured by Hugh Gaitskell. And although I was, 30 at the time, desperate to get in the government, I committed an act of pure madness and wrote an article called Credit Where It's Due, which was in praise of Hugh Gaitskell. And I sent it everywhere and couldn't get it published. And one night I was walking down the library corridor of the House of Commons, which was a long corridor. In those days the House met all night. And Ian MacLeod, the editor of The Spectator and a great Tory grandee, came towards me. Well, I say he came towards me. Mr. MacLeod was wounded in the war and therefore walked sideways. And I wasn't sure whether he was coming towards me or trying to avoid me. And this went on for a very long time. And suddenly he approached me and said to me, "You Hattersley," which is how Tory grandees spoke to young men in those days. And I said, "Yes, Mr. MacLeod," because that's how young men spoke to Tory grandees. And he said, "I've got your piece on Gaitskell." And I thought he was going to publish it. And he said, "I don't want that." I thought, "Why are you going to do all this trouble to get at me like a crab just to be rude?" And then he said, "Do you want to come and work for The Spectator? Would you like to write something called End Piece on the back page every week?" I always tell audiences in the south of England that my reaction is best described as "thou what." Perhaps here in the Midlands you know what's meant by "thou what" in Yorkshire. I mean, "thou what" means you speak to me in discernible language, the meaning of which I understand, but the message you convey is so improbable that unless you repeat your words verbatim, I shall find it difficult to believe you're serious. That is "thou what," which is what I felt. And he said, "Come and work for The Spectator." And that was the beginnings of the light essay, which I've tried to write for somebody ever since. In fact, I've written it for The Guardian every week except one for the last 17 years. The one, you'll be interested to know, was the day on which Princess Diana was killed. And I sent in an essay about something I know not what. And even though I'm wildly insensitive, when I heard the news that Princess Diana was dead, I thought my allegedly humorous end piece probably wouldn't work. So I better write one more related to the subject. And I heard the news, long accounts of Princess Diana's death, long accounts of Dodi Fayed's death, and at the end the newsreader said, "The driver also died." And I wrote a piece which began, "The driver also died," suggesting that perhaps there ought to be an equivalence in death, that sad though the deaths were of these two youngish people, "The driver also died" was an indication that in our society we were too keen on the famous and not sufficiently keen on the humble and meek. The Guardian, that great radical newspaper, wouldn't publish it, saying that the building will probably be burnt down by Dianaites on the Monday if such a thing appeared. But every other week it's appeared. And I tell you, it's a terribly flattering, self-flattering story, but I can't resist. When it was on a Saturday, I used to get letters from a rabbi which would have embarrassed a more modest man. And one day it moved from Saturday to Monday, and the rabbi wrote to me over the weekend saying, "Unbelievably, bereft by the absence of end piece, I tried my own hand at something over the weekend, and incredibly I chose the same subject as you. And although it's an indignity I impose upon you, will you read my version and write in the margins and send it back so that I can work hard and be someday almost as good as you are?" And I read his essay, and it was better than mine. And that's why I've never missed a week, because I think if I do, this bloody rabbi will be in the paper, and I'll never be able to get my space back again. But anyway, that was my abiding writing passion. Until I moved at the same time to Punch. I worked for Punch for about 8 years, writing an allegedly humorous article. I say allegedly because Corran sometimes used to phone my office and say, would I mark the jokes in the margin, so he knew which they were. And we used to have those Friday lunches at Punch. Punch would have had lunches every week for 120 years. And theoretically, they would decide on the subject of the big political cartoon. They dropped the political cartoon in 1952, but they weren't having the lunches. And all the Punch lunches would talk about writing. We were all writers. And that's what we talked about. We all talked about writing fiction. We all were essayists of a sort, but we knew that was the foothills of literature. The real achievement is fiction, and we all talked about it. Alan Corran was always about to write a novel. I don't know where he is tonight, but wherever he is, he'll be telling somebody he's going to start his novel on Sunday. Melvyn Bragg often had finished a novel the previous weekend. I don't know whether you saw Melvyn on Dame Evan Everett's show when she said, we've got the most remarkable people here, including a real novelist, Stand Up Melvyn, which he was foolish enough to do. And then Dame Edna said, everybody who had ever read one of Melvyn's novels, Stand Up. Well, we talked about writing novels all the time. And I knew that I wanted to write novels of a certain sort. I wanted to write what I think is called, indeed what I know is called, English realism. Novels which, as well as having a credible narrative, understandable dialogue, a plot that is at least conceivable, tell you something about a time and an age. I'm careful not to make the comparison, but I suppose Middlemarch, in a sense, is the great example of this. By reading Middlemarch, you know something about a market town in England, a time and place. And if it's a work of genius, you can be carried along by the most prosaic subjects. Old Wives' Tale, about a general store in the Potteries. Don't get much more prosaic than that. Storekeeper, if I can use the American expression, with two daughters, one flighty and attractive, one dull but dependable. I mean, this is the stuff of which boredom is made. But because it is written by a genius, it is a novel of genius. And that realism was what I wanted to write. And I couldn't think plot I quite wanted, had some ideas. And then suddenly I realized that the plot was in my head and in my heart and in my mind and in my life, and had been from just before my 50th birthday, when my father had died. My mother went to London after the funeral. We took her back to Sheffield. Huge pile of condolence letters, which she asked me to go through. And one of them was a form, which Catholics amongst you may recognize, which said, we have said prayers for the repose of the soul of Frederick Roy, and stuff about candles and masses. And then a signature with a little cross against it, which, atheist though I am, I recognize as the sign of a bishop. And then a note in immensely old handwriting, which said, as you will know, your father and I were at the English College in Rome together. Indeed, we started our careers as parish priests in the same diocese. And this was the discovery that my father had been a priest, which I didn't know, and that he left the priesthood to marry, or to be more precise, run away with my mother. Or to be very precise, pedal away with my mother, because they got on their bicycles and pedaled west from the Derbyshire, Nottingham, Coalfield, Shirebrook and Mansfield. My mother being a member of the Communist Party at the time. So it was a strange union. These days, she's still alive. These days, she said she was never a member of the Communist Party. But everybody in the Labour Party says they were never members of the Communist Party. But she was, and they went away together. My father having actually married her to somebody else, standing on the altar steps, married her to somebody else, then discovered they were in love and run away with her. And this struck me as a story of some passion and interest, and about some real issues, like what it was like to be an outcast in the 1930s, when, having got to Sheffield, which they believe was El Dorado, because both their father to be Sheffield men, who tell them that everything that was good was in Sheffield. These innocents, for that's what they were, thought if we get to Sheffield it'll be okay. Everything wasn't okay. And I realised that a plot was possible here. And I tell you one story about the plot to illustrate that I worked very hard on it. My publisher, I think rather unwisely, said this is not a novel, it's a trilogy. In fact, I think there were two books in it, not three. I'm reinforced in that view by the fact that I got very good reviews for book one and book two and terrible reviews for book three. But anyway, we wrote three books. I wrote three books. And did a good deal of research. I mean, I went to Rome, the English college in Rome, and went to the present Bishop of Nottingham to talk about what had happened. The Catholic Church is wonderfully mafia-like in that it has its contacts everywhere. And I went to lunch with the bishop and his secretary. And the bishop had a huge dossier on his desk, which was parishes all over England, Farnborough, where my father had been in school, all with information about my father. And he said, you want to know the full information? I said, yeah. He said, well, you know, your mother was married. Indeed, your father performed a ceremony. And we didn't believe and don't believe in divorce in the Catholic Church. And anyway, civil divorce was much more difficult then. So your mother couldn't marry your father until 1957. And there's a long pause around the table. And I think wanting to cover his embarrassment, I said, well, I've been a professional politician for 25 years now. And I've often been called a bastard. This is the first time I really... And at this moment, the secretary took out his wallet, took out a £5 note and gave it to the bishop. And I said, what's that for? He said, that's what His Grace bet me you'd say when I told him. Now, this, I think, is a very considerable put-down. But the novels came. I then wrote Prejudice History of Britain Since the War. In the middle of that, I was persuaded by my publisher to write a sort of self-satirical biography called Who Goes Home. It's very unusual for politicians to write self-satirizing biographies. Most political biographies really have the subtitle Vindicated at Last. They're all written to prove that we would have been Prime Minister had it not been for malign fate or perfidious colleagues or some simple quirk of destiny. And I thought politics was great fun, and I thought there were very many humorous moments in politics which were not properly represented, and that people outside regarded us all as a pretty humorous lot when really there's a great deal of amusement and joy in it, and I wrote about the joy. Because of that, 50 Years On was a year late. So we didn't, as we intended, publish it in 1990, but in 1991, which had the difficulty. Well, first of all, the title, because 51 Years On doesn't have quite the same resonance. Not 91. It was 45. It was because the Labour Party had been re-elected. That was the second problem. I'd hoped to finish the thing before the general election, because I didn't want to write about the new Labour government. I'm not wildly enthusiastic for new Labour, I'm old Labour. And I didn't want to write criticisms of the last chapter, not out of any misguided sense of loyalty, but because I knew all the reviews would deal with my criticisms of 6 months of Labour government and not deal with my analysis of 50 years of other governments between after the war. So I made a very short conclusion in which I thought I said what I really believe about the Prime Minister, who I know very well. He worked for me for 5 years. And I expressed my intense admiration for his remarkable talent, his great courage and industry, his absolute sincerity. What the Prime Minister does, he doesn't do to win elections. He does because he believes in it. I don't believe in it, but he does. And I paid him the tribute of saying I think he was, in my experience, absolutely unique. I can't imagine any other politician I've ever met who could have destroyed both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party in the same year. That's all quite extraordinary achievement. But anyway, after that came Buster's Diary, about which nothing more is to be said, because I can't get away from it. Wherever I go, I'm the man who wrote Buster's Diary. Melvyn Bragg, again, I don't know why he appears so often in these conversations, came up to me in the House of Lords when I made one of my rare appearances and said, I hear you've sold 100,000 copies of Buster's Diaries. And I'd no idea how many I'd sold. So I gave the only decent answer I could. I said, oh, far more than that, I said, far more than that. And Melvin said, you're going to write another book about a dog. And I said, no, I am not. I'm doing something else, and I don't want to be remembered as a man who writes books in the name of a dog. To which Melvin replied, better that than nothing. I'm still working on that, but anyway, I did the dog book. And then we now, in our looping run, come round to the last book, not the last book, the most recent book, the biography of Catherine and William Booth. Now let me, as a bridging passage, tell you why there has been such a variation. I actually believe in writing as a trade. I believe writing is a finite thing that people ought to be able to do in itself. I mean, writing is the ability to construct sentences that carry clear meaning. It's best done, I think, and Fowler is absolutely right in this, if your ear has a resonance for the English language. It's far better done if you observe the formal rules of grammar. But the formal rules of grammar must sound right when you hear them in your head. And writing is constructing sentences which obey those obligations and carry precise meanings. And if you are a writer, you ought to be able to write a variety of things. As in a way, if you're a bricklayer, you ought to be able to build houses and factories and walls and foundations. It is a specific thing called writing. It's not being a political correspondent or a music critic. The reason, God help me, that I was television critic for the Daily Express for 2 years, doing 6 columns a week, spending 2 days of my every week watching videos to write a 650-word column every weekday, was because I wanted to prove to myself that if you can write, you write. And that is my excuse, if an excuse is necessary, for moving from one area to another. It's not exactly the same technique. On the bricklayer analogy, I mean, sometimes you're doing one sort of bonding and sometimes you're doing another. But writing remains a finite thing which you ought to be able to do. Let me give you an example of why it sometimes changes marginally, but only marginally. If you're writing an essay of the sort I described, the sound of the sentence is much more important than its accuracy. I've just taken part in a Arnold Bennett program for radio, and I was looking at the video this morning that has come out, and it quotes Arnold Bennett as saying, of course, there really are 6 towns in the Potteries, but I don't like the word 6. The I isn't as hard and sharp as in 5. 5 is a much more positive-sounding word, and therefore I made it 5 towns, because 5 towns sounded right. Now, I understand that. I wrote a profile of Gore Vidal for The Guardian, because I do those big centerfold profiles. I'm just doing a profile of Vanessa Redgrave, which is almost the most difficult thing I've ever written in my life, but don't ask me why, but I am. Don't ask me why I'm doing it, because she fascinates me as a most accomplished actor, you would say. The difficulty is that she has theories about everything, like Shakespeare did in fact write The Tempest with Prospero as a woman. And when I say, how do you relate that to the context? She says, well, in fact, everybody speaks of her as a man because that's what she wants them to do. And I say, why do you wish you want them to do that? She says, because women under threat often find they can best defend themselves by pretending to be men. And I say, but throughout the play, she's a man. That shows how well she did it. I was doing a profile of Gore Vidal and went to see him in the south of Italy. And I like Gore Vidal very much and admire him, laugh at his jokes. You know, every time one of my friends succeeds, I die a little. And he said to me, do you ever use the word 12 or 12? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, I never do, he said. I think the word 12 is the most ugly word in the English language. Whatever I write, there cannot be 12 anything. They have to be 11 or 13. Fortunately, he said, I've never had to write about the apostles because I don't quite know how to deal with it. But the sound of 12 is all wrong. Well, I think you can do that in some sort of writing. But you can't do it in my last enterprise and my next enterprise, which is biography. The biography of William and Catherine Booth. Just published. And now beginning a biography of John Wesley, which is an immensely difficult task, as I will tell you when I've done 5 minutes on William and Catherine Booth. I came to William and Catherine Booth in the most strange, but I think in a sense, most appropriate way. The Salvation Army suggested I did it. They'd read my novels, or the important people had read my novels and said, why don't you write a novel on the life of William Booth? Which I have to say to you, though I did not say to them, seemed to be one of the most unappetizing proposals that's ever been put to me in my life. But out of courtesy, I said, well, I'll think about it. I then had lunch with my publisher and talking about quite different things and said, you know, you won't believe it, but this is what the Salvation Army suggested. And she said, well, by coincidence, we were talking about biographies, and there hadn't been a proper biography of William Booth ever, and there hadn't been any sort of biography since 1894, which was a hagiography of the worst sort, one of the great two-volume things that the Victorian produced, great swathes of extracts from diaries and letters combined, held together by single sentences. And we're thinking somebody ought to fill the gap. So I spoke for the Salvation Army and said, what about a biography? They said, great, you can have all the papers. We're moving our heritage centre from Judd Street in St Pancras to Victoria, Queen Victoria Street. Before all the papers go, you could have the first crack at these generally unclassified papers, and we'll give you some assistance in doing it. So I started looking at the papers, and whilst they were classifying them, said, I'll go along to the British Library and look at the correspondence. And the weekend before I went to the British Library, I found and I read W.T. Stead's great Victorian journalist monograph on William Booth, and it dealt almost entirely with William Booth's book In Darkest England and How to Get Out, published in 1880. The first plan ever to deal with unemployment and poverty. A lot of people had wanted to help the poor as they saw the poor in front of them, or give people the jobs as they met a man who was out of work or a woman who needed work. But the idea of a plan to end poverty and employment, nobody had conceived until William Booth thought of it. So I abandoned the letters for a bit. I said to my publisher, I'm going to do a Booth biography called William Booth and the Victorian Poor. I think if you disguised a horror, because you could think of it, William Booth and the Victorian Poor, when they made it into a musical, it wouldn't run on Broadway, would it? But I was going to write that. And having worked very hard on In Darkest England and the surrounding policies, I then went off to the British Library and started to go through the Booth correspondence with Mrs. Booth, Catherine Booth, to her husband during their long courtship and during the many months of their marriage when they were separated. And I became absolutely fascinated with Catherine Booth, who I believe to be one of the most significant women of the 19th century. Well, perhaps not significant, one of the most exceptional women of the 19th century. I mean, first of all, she was the perfect Victorian wife and mother. She ironed her husband's shirts. She made sure he had exactly the food that he wanted, which was very exacting and very precise. When he was ill, she was often more ill than he, but she looked after him and she soldiered on. She was the perfectly subservient wife at home. But externally, in other ways, she was 100 years ahead of her time. She believed in women's equality to men in the sight of God. The reason the Salvation Army always promoted women parallel with men, women had authority over men in the Salvation Army in 1860, when the Salvation Army, before the Salvation Army was formed, in the Christian mission which preceded it, it was because Catherine Booth would say, women are as good as men. And this extraordinary woman left school when she was 12, had a intellectual ability which was quite phenomenal. When William Booth was a Methodist minister in the Northeast, a very famous American preacher called Phoebe Palmer came over. She wasn't allowed to preach from the pulpit because the Methodists didn't allow that sort of thing. But her husband, who was an ordained minister of the Methodist Church, preached a sermon. Phoebe Palmer then spoke from below the pulpit steps to make sure it wasn't a sermon. Then the resident minister spoke from the pulpit. But even this was found unacceptable to the Orthodox Methodists at the time. The local Methodist preacher, the local Methodist minister, gave a long sermon, turned it into a lecture, then published a pamphlet on the sins of the women's ministry. And down the road in Gateshead, Catherine Booth, aged 24, writes her pamphlet to refute it. The most extraordinary, complicated, detailed understanding of what the Bible had to say about women and the church. I mean, first of all, she goes through all the Old Testament prophets who were women. Then she deals with St. Paul and the famous insistence in church, let the women keep quiet. She finds another passage from St. Paul in which he says, it is shameful for women to preach in church without their heads covered. And she says, if it's shameful for them to preach in church without their heads covered, he must be saying, by implication, that it isn't shameful for them to preach in church with their heads covered. Ergo, women can preach in church in the right circumstances. And then she had the killer line, which was that on the point of the resurrection, it was two women who were chosen to bring the basic truth of Christianity, truth in very heavily inverted commas, the basic fact of Christianity, the resurrection. It was two women who brought the news that the tomb was empty and Christ was risen. If the two women were chosen to do that, my word, shouldn't they be allowed to preach from pulpits in Methodist churches? And from then on, she never looked back. Never looked back. For a time, she was more important and certainly more famous than her husband. She was keeping the family when he was out of work by giving lectures in North London, for which she was paid, and preaching in South London, for which she wasn't. While all this was going on, she was having 8 babies in 12 years, all of whom were reared to adulthood, itself an extraordinary thing for Victorian England. And then she was developing her advanced views on women's issues. Not time for me to go into any of them in great detail, but I'll just give you one, which was regarded as scandalous in the 19th century, and I guess it's regarded as scandalous in some parts of the West Midlands now. Namely, that prostitutes were more likely to be the victims of their circumstances than the perpetrators of evil, and the people who ought to be prosecuted and rendered illegal were the men who used prostitutes. Very, very unpopular view in England in 1870, 1880, 1890, but she was fighting for it. Well, I wanted to write their story, and that's what I did. And I ended it by speculating, as I must end now by speculating, about why it is that these two extraordinary people have been so neglected over the last 100 years. I mean, Booth was extraordinary in himself, in this untutored pawnbroker's clerk from Nottingham. By the time he died, was the head of a worldwide organization. In his last 10 years, he went to places like Korea, Mexico, to Australia, to meet the battalions of the Salvation Army that were formed there. In his last 5 years, he opened the Senate 3 times in the United States with Salvation Army prayers, had tea with 2 presidents of the United States, became a terrible old creep, I might say. This man who was been the great champion of the poor, discovered all the crown heads of Europe who greeted him and gave him cups of tea were really great men and women. You know, the Prince of Wales, the old Prince of Wales, 2 Princes of Wales ago, Edward VII, who he denounced as a libertine. When he was actually invited to Buckingham Palace, he talked about the cheerful visage of a man who is clearly, deep down inside, entirely moral. He liked being feted by the rich and the famous, but he achieved this extraordinary thing. And I think he achieved it in ways that made it inevitable that the establishment attacked him. He liked to think of himself as God's soldier, which he was, but he was also God's salesman. And he realized where his market was. His market was amongst the industrial poor, who were neglected first by the Church of England and then by the Methodist Church. People who were godless in his view because God never sent his disciples to reach out to them. So he operated in the area where he could most likely succeed. And he did what he believed, from his own observations, was most likely to make the new recruits, the new converts. First of all, he realized that the families living in poverty were more likely to sin than families living in affluence. A wonderful paradox in his life, deeply anti-Calvinist, profoundly opposed to the idea of the elect, as he had to be as a young man as a travelling preacher. I mean, travelling preachers were paid by results. Phoebe Palmer made 150 converts in Southampton, and for 50 guineas, you'll make 250 converts next Sunday in Portsmouth. Now, if you're paid by results, the travelling evangelist, you can't afford to believe that a few people are God's elect and the rest are condemned to eternal damnation. You have to have everybody in the hall standing up and saying, take me, I am saved. Booth did not believe in predestination, but he did believe in economic determinism, that the conditions in which we live do affect the rest of our lives, that the poor are more likely to steal than the rich, that the poor living in fetid, overcrowded, back-to-back houses in South and East London would go to public houses to drink because that was a cheerful place to be when their homes were depressing places to be. And he popularised the view that there wasn't a distinction between the deserving and undeserving poor. He was a great popularizer of other people's ideas, and he took Carlyle's concept called the cab horse principle. Carlyle said, when a London cab horse falls down, we pick it up, get it back between the shafts, and send it off to do its work. We don't say, why did this cab horse fall down? Is it the cab horse's own fault? Does it deserve our help to get it back on its feet? We should treat human beings in the same way. Booth became a great advocate of the cab horse principle. And that was where his market was. That's where the people who he could afford to convert and were willing to be converted were. And he behaved in ways which he knew was attractive to them. The regimental uniforms, the banners, the bands, didn't like any of them in principle. Part of the Methodist movement that thought God wanted the unadulterated human voice, not instruments to sing his praises. But he realized people would march behind bands, so he had bands. And he realized that what he called the doctors of the Methodist Church, all the Methodist ministers were doctors of divinity, couldn't appeal to new converts in the way a man who was a reformed sinner could. The man standing on the corner of the road who said, I was a drunkard, my sons deserted me, my wife left me, I lost my job, I was kicked out of my house, I was living under a bridge in London, and then I found God. And now I'm back at work, my wife has returned, my sons are proud to know me, I'm buying my own house. He had this wonderful technique for convincing the industrial poor that God was on their side, and if they worked with him, he'd work with them. So Booth was immensely important in his own right, but he alienated nearly all the people who formed opinions during his lifetime, some of whom thought he was ridiculous, because he had this mock military uniform and a top hat and umbrella. Some of whom thought he was dangerous. Professor Huxley thought he was going to lead something like the Paris Commune of 1870 and take over the government of Great Britain. Many of whom thought he was Antichrist. And some of whom thought he was attacking the vested interests, the brewers in particular. And because of all those things, because the Times could never say a good word about him, I've read everything the Times wrote about him. And not even at the point of his death, when he had the third largest funeral in British history. Number one, Queen Victoria. Number two, the Duke of Wellington. Number three, William Booth. The account of his funeral, they could not bring themselves to call him general without putting inverted commas round the word general. Now, all these things diminished him in his own lifetime. The last 10 years, he was a patriarch who was quite admired, but then forgotten about. And what I like to think is that this little effort of mine will gradually begin to re-establish him in a few people's minds. It's not going to sweep the country with Booth fever, but one or two people will realise that this great man has been ignored and shouldn't have been ignored before. My final word, because we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about, is it led to me doing another biography, a biography of John Wesley. And if any of you are thinking of writing biographies, let me give you this piece of very clear advice. William Booth is an ideal subject with which to begin. Because first of all, there hasn't been a biography of him for 100 years. So you're not going to read letters in the Times Literary Supplement saying Roy Hatterley was quite wrong about Booth in 1874. He wasn't there, he didn't do that, and his wife wasn't with him anyway. There's no other authority on the subject. Secondly, Booth was a simple man. He was very anti-intellectual. Wonderful letters from his wife telling him when they were separated that he must get books, have a book box, take around the country with him. He couldn't pick up the sentences, copy them down out of the book, make marks in the margin. Wonderfully unintellectual. And it's very much easier to describe action than it is to deal with intellectual processes. John Wesley, I have to tell you, about whom about 730 biographies have been written, so I think we can expect some letters of correction when it's published, was an intellectual of the most convoluted sort. And I've not started writing about him yet, or indeed researching his life, because I've spent 6 months trying to wrestle with his theology. Justification, which is not what you think, or the non-Methodists among you think, which is not the demonstration that you're entitled to do what you did. It's a step along the long road to sanctification. And sanctification in life, which is the ability to become a saint without the inconvenience of dying first. All these things were ideas that Wesley wrestled with all his life. He didn't establish a formal position and a firm position when he was 25 at Christchurch or 30 at Lincoln's College. He kept changing his views as he went along. That's a hard sort of biography to write. Next time, I'm very practical, since I do it all the time, way. If you write, you ought to be able to write. And you ought to be able to write almost anything. And you ought to be able to do it by the simple advice that was given to me 50 years ago. National Association of Labour Student Organisations had a broadsheet, which we call the magazine, edited by a man called Leslie Stone, who was eventually a very senior BBC overseas producer, and they wanted two articles from what were thought to be the two up-and-coming student politicians, one of whom was chairman of the association 1 year, and the other was chairman the following year. The first was me, and the second was a young man now generally forgotten called Brian Walden. And I used to do a piece every month, and Brian never did his. And Leslie Stone said to me, what Brian doesn't understand is what you have to do about writing. You don't pace about thinking of a great idea, or sit down with your eyes closed trying to decide what the real sentence is. You make marks on paper. And the marks on paper may be wholly inadequate. It may be a sentence of which you're entirely ashamed afterwards, but then you cross it out and start again. Writing is an essentially physical operation. You've got to do it to get it right. You've got to make marks on paper to get it started. And I conclude by saying making marks on paper is now the joy of my life. And another 30 years. My mother is going strong at 95, so I reckon there's probably another 15 books before we're finished. And thank you very much for letting me talk about them. Thank you very much.
Well, now's the opportunity for you to ask Roy Hattersley some questions about his life as a writer. And perhaps while you're just thinking those up, I could start you off by asking you, Roy, William and Catherine Booth and now John Wesley, three people for whom religion was central and central to their social concern. You, as an avowed atheist, drawn to writing about them. Where does religion fit?
Well, I mean, first of all, I guess it's an attempt to justify what I was saying about writers' right. If I was writing a biography of Caligula, you wouldn't say you've never been a Roman emperor. You've never lived in imperial Rome. You'd hope, perhaps vainly, that I could work hard enough and assimilate enough to be able to write about imperial Rome. If I was writing a technical thing, I mean, if I were, how Lloyd Wright got the first aeroplane off the ground, you wouldn't expect me to be a pilot or an aeronautic engineer. And I think it's part of the superstition of religion, if I may offend some of you, that there's the implication, which you quite rightly ask about, because everybody does, how it is a person of my non-views, you've been too polite, but in a sense it has the effrontery to do it. Now, I think I have the effrontery to do it for the writing reason I've tried to describe. And also I think there's something to be said for the objectivity that comes from being outside this particular band of perception. I mean, if I was a Catholic, if I was a high Catholic, what would I be thinking as I read William Booth's heresies, because that's what they were. If I was a Muslim, what would I be thinking when I read William Booth's attacks on what he described as the savages of Egypt and the Sudan? He didn't think they were savages because they killed General Gordon. He thought they were savages because they worshipped an alien god. I think it allows a degree of objectivity. Now, I think I'm more interested in social ideas in one sense, but the theology does fascinate me because it's just complicated ideas. I have to say to you that a number of people, principally members of the Salvation Army, believe that deep down inside this is God working through me, and that one day I'm going to come to a meeting like this, and instead of talking about literature, I'm going to walk to the front and say, "Hallelujah, I am saved, God take me." But I don't think that's likely to happen. I'll tell you an anecdote, if you'll forgive me. I'm at what Dennis Healy calls my politician's anecdotage. Dennis Healy says politicians go through three stages if they've been controversial. They're first highly respected, they're then much loved, and they're then dead. And these are three stages of what he calls the anecdotage, which is my excuse for telling you this story. I, out of gratitude to the Salvation Army, spoke at two or three things for them, including their senior officer rally in Westminster Hall, which went on, the service at the rally went on for 2.5 hours, and the sermon lasted for 40 minutes. No, an hour and 40. Sermon lasted for an hour and 40 minutes. A lot of good music and bands. And I spoke briefly on Booth, and then the commanding general, General Gowan, thanked me for what I said, thanked me for my honesty in admitting to being an atheist. And then said, I was sitting here, he was standing there. He said, Bramwell Booth, speaking to the Methodist Conference in 1929, looked out into the hall and said, I see before me many salvationist faces. And the Methodist ministers cried, no, General, no, we are not salvationists. And Bramwell replied, some of the best salvationists don't even know they are. At this point, he put his hand on my head, and everybody stood up and applauded. And I tried not to look embarrassed, more important, not to look resentful. But I don't think it's going to happen. But I do think it's possible to be objective about these things, as I could be, I hope, objective if I could write a biography of Lord Salisbury, as I hope in 50 years on I've been objective about Margaret Thatcher, saying I think she's going to be one of the great prime ministers of this century because she turned politics round. She changed the nature of politics. She changed and bit us to political ideas. Nothing has been the same in politics since Margaret Thatcher. Now, I think I'm pretty objective about her, and I hope I can be the same about religious figures. Too long an answer, I apologise. I used to be a politician.
Thank you. Let's have some more questions. Yes.
You told us that we learned by the books of Apparition of the Soul, and writer wants to be matched by Apparition of the Soul's Apparition.
I'm also getting deaf, so I'll probably be doing it
wrong.
Question, in case you didn't hear it, because I went across to be confidential about it, was I'd written that Michael Foot was, as a politician, was a very good writer. And could I think of any people who'd done the two things in parallel? And I can't. I'm not a great admirer of Disraeli. I mean, everybody says mine were communist and wonderful. I regard those as over-romantic, semi-gothic novels. I mean, I can't get to grips with a son of a noble family who decided it was his duty to become a factory inspector, meeting the woman he loved by moonlight in a ruined church. I mean, I'm afraid I can't deal with that sort of novel. So I can't think of any politicians, at least in this country, who've been good writers. I don't think I can think of many in other countries either, in the way you can't think of many soldiers who've been good writers. Ian Forster said there's only been two men of action in Europe in the last 100 years who've also been good writers. I think it's the same about politicians. But let me tell you why I said that about Michael Foot. We had a debate in the House of Commons when I was first Shadow Home Secretary on the inner cities. And there were riots in the inner cities at the time. And I opened the debate. When I came into my office the next day, there was a letter, top of the envelope, from the leader of the opposition, Michael's big handwriting, Roy Hattersley, private, confidential. I opened it. And inside was another envelope with Michael's handwriting, to be opened only by Roy Hattersley. So I opened it. And inside there was a letter which began, "I would have thought, after your appalling conduct yesterday, your resignation would have been on my desk when I arrived this morning. Since it is not there, I hope we will present yourself to you in the morning and either excuse your conduct or resign from the Shadow Cabinet at once." And I really thought, what have I done? I thought I spoke reasonably in the debate. Went home immediately afterwards. And then said, "P.S. I've made some interim comments on your conduct over leaf." And over leaf was a photograph of my end piece on Dorothy Parker, with Michael writing in the margin why I've been unfair about Dorothy Parker. And I realised this was a joke. Not in my view a very good joke, was a joke. But this was a two-day debate on the inner cities, and Brixton was burning. And having opened the debate on the Monday, MP's day, I was to close it on the Tuesday. So I was spending all morning finding out about Brixton and preparing as best you can the speech for the wind-up, which you can't prepare until you've got a lot of alternatives. And all the time, messages were coming up from Michael's secretary. "Is Roy coming down to see Michael? Michael had been looking forward to it since he got up this morning." And in the end, I had to send a curt little note saying, "Important though Dorothy Parker is to both of us, winding up the debate adequately this evening is more important today." And this seemed to me the quintessential Michael Foot, which was fascinating as a literary figure. When my wife and I went to see him in 83, first week of the general election campaign, the general election campaign was in chaos in 83, and it was thought that two or three of us should come together and form a committee and pull the campaign together. So we went down from Birmingham Sparkbrook to see Michael. Had dinner with Michael and Jill. All he would talk about was Robert Blake and Jerusalem. Because Jill was writing a book on women's something. And Michael had a theory, for all I know, it may be right, that Jerusalem was written in praise of free love. And while we should have been talking about the election campaign, Michael was going through the poem explaining the exegesis, what that meant, what the double meaning was, what Blake stood for. Now, this is a marvellous way to spend an evening, but not when the Labour Party is running the worst election campaign we've had in this country since manhood suffrage. You want to be doing something else. And that's what I felt about Michael. Sorry. I think political novels are very difficult to write. I think they're difficult to write for two or three reasons. And the answer, of course, is I never have. First of all, politics ought to produce the same human emotions as other trades. I mean, what you ought to write about, if you're writing good novels, in my view, is love, hate, disappointment, failure, satisfaction, completion. You ought to write about the basic human emotions. And politicians don't have those basic human emotions any more than dentists or pre-stressed concrete engineers. But when you write about a political novel, you are inclined to elevate the politics above what novels should be about, which is the basic human feelings. It becomes ambition on the front bench, disappointment on the back bench, lust in Committee Room 15, and it becomes immensely artificial. And if I can offend some authorities on Victorian literature amongst you, as I'm sure there are. I mean, I find this in Trollope. I mean, I don't know about Trollope's ecclesiastical novels, but I think Trollope's political novels always suffer from politics being artificially brought in, as if politics was more important than the basic human emotions of the people who are there involved. I mean, Trollope is great when he produces little vignettes of what life is like in the House of Commons. Because he had been appointed to the Treasury bench, it seemed little to matter that his wife loved another man more than she loved him. That's Glencora, McCluskey, and Plantagenet Palliser. If men were only appointed to the Treasury bench if they believe the world to be triangular, then there would be a great clamour in favour of triangularity ringing around the House of Commons. These little one-line sentences are great, but it's not what makes a great novel, and I think it's very difficult to do, and not to do in the way I would want to do. I mean, I think it probably, if you've been in the House of Commons 33 years, and you know the difference between a preposition and a verb, I think it's probably easy to write a best-selling political novel. Because the newspapers say, this is really not a novel. This is Roy Hattersley telling what he was really like. They really did behave like this when they went on the deputation to Cuba. Believe it or not, there was an orgy above the air and the Aeroflot plane flying over the South Pole. And I think that probably sells novels. It ain't what I want to do, I'm afraid.
Bearing in mind your interest in sports, and obviously another biography as well, I wondered which of your own sporting heroes you would look like to have written a biography about. And if you have already done it, I'm sorry I haven't read it.
Well, I haven't. And although you haven't read a sporting biography of mine, I have seen the logo on your pullover. And it's not because of that that I say that if I wanted to write a biography of a sporting hero, it would be Len Hutton. And it would be Len Hutton for a lot of reasons. I'm a very tribal person, and I was brought up in Sheffield in the 40s and 50s. Every little boy in Sheffield in the 40s and 50s knew that they wanted to be like Len Hutton. When I was playing for Sheffield YMCA, Sheffield Grammar School, I used to pull my cap in between balls, believing this was the sign of a great batsman, because that's what he did. Didn't realise it was the sign of a neurotic. But I wasn't a neurotic, but I did it because Len Hutton did it. But I think, actually, if I can be serious about Len for a moment, who I came to know towards the end of his life, I mean, I think he was a real hero. I mean, this man was the greatest young batsman of the first 40 years of the century. The age of 24, scored 364 runs in 13 hours, 20 minutes against the Australians, the Oval, caught Hassett, bowled O'Reilly. Then there's the World War. He's injured, not wounded, but injured in the World War. He has 2 inches of bone taken out of his arm, and his left arm, which for good batsmen is the leading arm, is 2 inches shorter than it ought to be. Then in 1944, he starts practicing with a boy's bat. And by 1945, he is a world-class batsman again, going on to score 100 hundreds, going on to make 3,000 runs in the season, going on to make the most runs anybody made in one single month in 1947, going to lead England to win back the Ashes. Now, this is the real stuff of drama. I mean, this is a man overcoming adversity in the most extraordinary way. And the difficulty is, if you write it about Len, it seems to be a sporting saga. In fact, it's a human drama which could apply to anybody doing it. And I think that's rather better if you can write it about a humbler figure. You know, people of this sort in Arnold Bennett who've triumphed over adversity but are so anonymous that you get the emotion out of it rather than the glitz out of it. But Len was a great man for that reason, if no other. He's also the meanest man I ever met, but that's another story.
Question over here.
Do I have a little book that
in your head? Do you have the next book in your head?
Next book in my head. I know what I want. Yes. I know what I want the next book to be. I'm very taken about the idea of double biographies. And I think I want to do the Brownings. And I know barely more about poetry than I know about religion, but I think I can apply the same rule, and I want to do the Brownings because of my obsession with Victorian England. I might be diverted to do a book on the return of the Catholic hierarchy to England in the 1840s. It won't be a book very many people buy, but I'm fascinated by the fact that the Catholic Church was re-established in England. And Newman made this great thing, it has come again, the second, etc., etc., etc. And it had an immense influence on our entire lives and culture, which nobody recognises. The House of Parliament wouldn't be built in the way they are had there not been a great flowering of Catholic culture. The Pre-Raphaelites probably wouldn't have had the success they did had there not been this great Catholic influence. And I think I would like to write about that. I guess my publisher isn't going to let me do it,
Well, at least they didn't pay me anything for doing it, because she wouldn't let me do a biography of Pugin, saying to me, who do you think is going to buy a biography of Pugin? And I said, well, sure, a lot of architects are. And she said, architects only buy big books with pictures in them that cost 50 guineas. So we didn't do a biography of Pugin. So I've got a lot of ideas I want to do. And I actually want to go back to writing fiction. Every time I write a book, I'd say I'm going to do another novel. But I want to do a novel of a more up-to-date sort. I want to do a novel about between the wars. It's not Love on the Dole, but about between the wars. And I might well do that. But I mean, I know whatever happens when I finish Wesley, I'm going to be starting something else.
Well, I'm sure you want me to thank Roy Hattersley. I think he's given us a marvellous example of his love of language and his zest for life and his sense of fun and his range in what he's told us tonight. And if some of you want to come down and have a word with him or have a book signed by him, he'd be very willing to do that. His books are in the bookshop, which is open on the table just as you go in, and he'll be here for a little while if you want to go and buy. And if you take your ticket, they'll give you 20% off. But from all of us, a very warm thank you for coming and joining our session on writers.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for coming.